Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes after the hour. Boy, when you think of the great moments of history, I mean, World War II. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We're at war, and Roosevelt is out there asking people to volunteer, you know, asking people to sign up. My father went out and volunteered, you know, signed up to fight in World War II, as did so many of that generation. He had, and by the way, Roosevelt had four sons. All four of his sons joined the military. Three of them served in combat. John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And, of course, Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum, this week at the Center County Republican Party, asking them to step up and serve their country. Yes, Rick Santorum, that great statesman, asking the people in the audience to go the ultimate measure. To put a Santorum bumper sticker on their car.
What I'm asking all of you tonight is not to put on a uniform, put on a bumper sticker. Is it that much to ask? Is it that much to ask to step up and serve your country?
By putting a Santorum bumper sticker on your car. Oh, no, Rick, it's not asking too much. Well, actually, it is. Yeah. I'm sorry, it's so easy to turn that into a cheap shot, but it is. I mean, you know, this is statesmanship in the modern Republican Party. I mean, how many of these guys are sending their own family members off to fight and die in Iraq? Between the Bush and Cheney families, there are dozens of military-aged young men and women, none of them serving. And you can extend that out to the whole web. You go through Wolfowitz and Pearl and Feith and Rumsfeld and the whole bunch of them. And then you go to all the Republicans in the Senate and the House. I believe there's one member who has a party member, you know, who has a family member who is serving. So strange goings on, you know, just strange goings on. But it's always nice to hear from Rick Santorum about the true meaning of service.
What I'm asking all of you tonight is not to put on a uniform. Put on a bumper sticker.
There you go. Put on a bumper sticker. Meanwhile, strange goings on in Alaska. And, in fact, those of you listening on our affiliate KUDO in Alaska, in Anchorage, Alaska, greetings to you. And you already know about this because, and I just, you know, a tip of the hat to Rich and the folks at KUDO, who have been put together some spoof ads around this. This is great. Here's the story. When the Alaska Democratic Party looked at the official tallies for the 2004 election, and then they looked at the tallies that Diebold came up with, they found, shall we say, a discrepancy. For example, Lisa Murkowski received almost 150,000 votes, and President Bush got almost 200,000, but if calculated district by district, Murkowski would have gotten an extra 80,000 and an additional 100,000 for President Bush. Very strange. Very strange results. So the Democratic Party went to the state, and they said, you know, these numbers from Diebold don't seem to be the same as the numbers that the state is posting on its website. What's going on? We'd like to see the original files. In fact, to quote Kay Brown, the Alaska Democratic Party, she said, "We must be able to verify the accuracy of our elections. It's fundamental to the whole process that people can have confidence in the election results." So the State Division of Elections' refusal to let us have the file, because that's what happened. The state said, "No, you can't have the files. You can't see the data. She says, that just means that the data that they're using for the past election as well as for future elections will not be subject to public review, and this is wrong, and we need to get the situation straightened out. Now, why would the state of Alaska say no to the Democratic Party? You can't see the election files from 2004. You think, is it because the state of Alaska is covering something up? Well, no, actually the state of Alaska, I mean, maybe, but as far as anybody can tell, the state of Alaska actually wanted to give them the files. They couldn't. Because the elections in Alaska, like in much of the United States, perhaps most of the United States, have been outsourced. They've been outsourced to a private corporation, in this case, Diebold. And Diebold says, we will not show you those files. They are proprietary. They represent trade secrets. And therefore, you may not have it. You may not have it. This from Web Center 11. I'm assuming this is Channel 11 News in Anchorage. The Alaska Democratic Party says there are major discrepancies in the numbers from the 2004 election. However, the State Division of Elections has denied access to the public records that could verify the election's accuracy. They claim the electronic computer file that contains all the final vote tallies is proprietary information belonging to Diebold Election Systems. And Diebold Election Systems, their position on this, you can't have it. You cannot have it. And so, you know, Democrats are saying, we got a problem here. The Anchorage Daily News, Democrats also contend that more than 2,000 Alaskans cast valid absentee ballots that weren't counted in the official totals. They say unless they get the entire file, they won't be able to understand what caused the bizarre and inaccurate reports from Alaska's 2004 election. As Ms. Brown said, the Democratic Party spokesman, these votes belong to us. These are a public record. It's wrong that a contractor like Diebold can keep us from seeing the record. This is why it's wrong to privatize the vote. And the folks at the Air America affiliate, KUDO, in Anchorage, Alaska, that is carrying this program, and as I said, tip of the hat to you, put together a couple of ads. I just have to share these with you. This is just so great. Here's one of the first ones that put together by the folks at KUDO.
Attention, politicians. Do your opponents have a political machine? Well, we can help you grow them one better. You haven't met a political machine unless you've teamed up with a Diebold machine. With Diebold on your side, you can't be beat. And no unsightly paper trails, no expensive recounts, no delays in your inauguration. Not with Diebold. At Diebold, we give you the results you want with the push of a button. Back in the old days, counting ballots was so dull, boring, tedious, and the results never what you hoped for. Not anymore. At Diebold, we've taken vote counting and added creativity. Call Diebold today and start building your political dynasty. Ask about our double money back guarantee if your candidate is not elected. Diebold. We don't count because you don't count.
This is great. This, of course, is a spoof ad. These are just spoof ads that were put together by the folks at KUDO. And here's another one. This is.
If you need someone to count on, count me.
Love the music.
Someone you can rely on.
Are you a Republican election official? Diebold voting machines make your job easy. For instance, in Alaska, our Diebold vote total shows President George Bush getting almost 191,000 votes. But if you add up the total for the president in each of the 40 election districts,
I've got your number and more.
Counted by Diebold AccuVote machines, Bush got 293,000 votes. That's a difference of 101,000 votes. Confused? That's our goal. The press, the public, the Democrats, they'll never get it. And they never will, because we keep our computer counting code a big secret.
It's easy. I take a candy from a baby.
Who really needs elections? At Diebold, we program your future.
There you go. This is just spectacular. Congratulations to the folks at KUDO for producing some great political satire with these spoof ads and pointing out a very real issue. I got to tell you, getting into the news, and we're going to talk also about, you know, what's going on. Are the Democrats going to filibuster Mr. Alito? One can hope. The toll-free number for your member of the United States Senate, 888-355-3588. We'll get into that. I got to tell you about what's going on in India, too. Amazing stuff. 15 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hart.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, hi, I'm London, and I just wanted to personally thank my Republican friends in Congress for trying to get rid of that mean old inheritance tax. I already stand to inherit a fortune, and because of you, I'll get millions more. I know the government has a lot of debt, and it has benefits to our soldiers, but they're used to making sacrifices. I'm not. Thanks again, Republicans, for watching. You're so high.
The old you razzle-dazzled them.
Indeed he did.
You gave them an box of flash and it made
indeed he did. And then I get an email from... from this guy. He says, I listen to your show regularly, and every time I hear you say, people that make their living sitting by the pool waiting for their dividend check to arrive, actually my phrase is, people who earn their living sitting on their butts by the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. He says, I just want to reach through the radio and strangle you. Tell me, what do you think the few people that make their living that way did to get those dividend checks? Could it be they worked for it, you jackass? Or do you actually think there's a dividend fairy that magically starts sending them dividend checks? Pull your head out of your, you moron. Says, I'm not going to trash the guy by giving you his email address. But in any case, the Walton heirs and Paris Hilton. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yep. I got it. They worked real hard for that money. And what we have now with a 15% maximum tax rate for somebody who earns their living by investing is that what we have said is that there are basically three ways that you can earn your living in the United States. You can do it with your mind, with the efforts of your mind. We typically refer to these as white collar jobs, although there's a lot of mind work that goes into blue collar jobs as well. But you know, you can do it with the power of, you know, an education, that kind of thing. You can do it with your mind. You can do it with your body. You can do labor. And that's not to say that labor doesn't involve a lot of intellect. In fact, labor can be very sophisticated intellectually. I don't mean to diminish it, but basically body, mind, or you can put money to work for you. There's three ways that you can get an income. And that money that you put to work for you may be inherited money, or it may be money that you earned with your body or your mind, or both. But what Bush has said is if you are that special class of people who earn their livings by investing, whether you're smart or dumb, whether you're strong or weak, the people who are earning their livings out there by the sweat of their brow, you know, whether it's hard thought or hard physical work, they're going to pay the maximum income tax rate in the 30s. They're going to have to pay Social Security taxes. They're going to be subject to other taxes, alternative minimum taxes. But if you earn your living simply by taking cash and investing it and getting a return in the form of dividends from companies, your maximum income tax rate is going to be 15%, and you're going to pay no Social Security taxes. And what astounds me is that this thing passed 2 years ago. Bush pushed this thing through, and the Republicans in the House and Senate, and I'll bet you 90% of Americans, if you asked them, did you know that if you earn your living by investing, you're a separate class of citizen in terms of income tax law. You only pay 15% maximum tax. Whereas if you are, most Americans would say, I didn't know that. As far as I can tell, this was absolutely totally not covered by the media in the United States. So anyhow, that's a, and for that bumper, it's a, well, the folks over at WD40.com, and thanks for the tip of the hat. It says, hey, guys, during his radio show, Tom Hartman called for everyone to contact all the Democratic senators in the next day or so and tell them to filibuster Alito. Said it's time to give our Democratic senators a spine transplant. Indeed. Now, what they've done is they've put together a nice list here. The senators that they think are most likely to spearhead a filibuster, and by the way, you can get this link, drop into our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. You can drop in there, and the folks in the chat room will give you the link. It's also over on a message board. And also the phone number for the program, just FYI, our toll-free number, 866-440-8466, 440-THOM, all across the United States. Anyhow, the senators most likely to spearhead a filibuster, the ones that, if we can get them cranked up, they may make this happen. Because it only takes one senator to step forward and do it, although they're going to have at least 40 people in the party along with them to make it stick. The ones most likely to spearhead a filibuster, who should probably be hearing from us all right now, Barbara Boxer, Robert Byrd, Joe Biden, Dick Durbin, Dianne Feinstein, Ted Kennedy, John Kerry. Boy, that would surprise me, but that's on the list. Patrick Leahy, Carl Levin, and Chuck Schumer. On the other hand, there are some Democratic senators who may break and run. Ben Nelson, Kent Conrad, Tim Johnson, Blanche Lincoln, Mark Pryor, and Mary Landrieu. And so we need to let them know, hey, don't just vote no. Vote for a filibuster. Make a filibuster happen. The toll-free number in Congress, 888-355-3588. If you can't get through on that one, try 888-818-6641. If 818-6641 doesn't work, if you have free long-distance service or you've got unlimited minutes or whatever, you want to call directly into the switchboard, the main line right to Congress, you can simply ask for your senator or one of your senators. Each one of us has two of them. And you can call anybody else's senator as well. 202-225-3121 is the main number for the United States Senate. So this fellow, this Sam Alito, just so incredibly toxic. After the break, I'll share with you some of the specifics. But, you know, broadly speaking, you just look at it. The use of the Commerce Clause, Alito talking about the Commerce Clause, and the same as John Roberts. I mean, basically they're saying the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, all these things, they would argue, and they will. I guarantee you the day will come, because Roberts is already, with this toad case in California where he said the toad doesn't deserve protection under the Endangered Species Act because it doesn't engage in interstate commerce. They will argue that these institutions should not be there. Presidential power. Unchecked presidential power. You want that? You got Alito. The end of safe and legal abortion in the United States. You want that? Get Alito. The end of affirmative action, and on it goes. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now George Bush, he is the man. He landed in Afghanistan. We'll get Osama, was his crack. And now we're stranded in Iraq. He told old Rumsfeld on the green, now you're the best I've ever seen. Just heed my words and you'll go far and help me win my daddy's war.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program, brought to you today in part by Eco Wine, the organic wine company. 1-888-ECOWINE. 1-888-ECO-WINE for organic French wines. And some really cool tasting stuff, just got to tell you. Stretched by frequent troop rotations to Iraq and Afghanistan, the Army has become a thin green line that could snap. This is from USA Today, unless relief comes soon, according to a study for the Pentagon. Andrew Krepinovich, a retired Army officer who wrote the report under a Pentagon contract, concluded that the Army cannot sustain the pace of troop deployments to Iraq long enough to break the back of the insurgency. He also suggested that the Pentagon's decision announced in December to begin reducing the force in Iraq this year was driven in part by a realization that the Army was overextended. And the article goes on. I'm saying, Bush is doing what John Murtha called for. He's just going to call it something different. And he's going to basically, claim victory and say and go home. He has to. Back to put a punctuation mark on the Alito call, the Gang of 14. These are the seven Republicans and seven Democrats who have said that they will block a filibuster. Remember this back during the Roberts thing, that they would get together and block a filibuster, prevent a filibuster from happening. The seven Democrats in this group have to be reached. They have to be recessed. Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, Robert Byrd of West Virginia, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who has already said he's going to support Alito. A tragedy. Hopefully we can get him to change his mind. Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, Mark Pryor of Arkansas, and Ken Salazar of Colorado. These Democrats need to be reached at the toll-free number for Congress, 1-888-355-3588. I'm going to tell you what's going on in India. I mentioned that at the beginning of the hour. India's cabinet, this is from an article by P.R. Venkat and John Larkin in today's Wall Street Journal. India's cabinet approved direct foreign investment in its retail market. Remember we talked about this? I believe it was earlier in the week or last week. That 95% of all retail sales in India are done by local mom-and-pop shops, and Walmart is lobbying to change that, lobbying against it. And now India's cabinet has just approved one small change. Now, India gets it. I mean, you got folks like Tom Friedman running around saying, oh, look at India, if you want to see the future, the world is flat, blah, blah, blah. And India doesn't think the world is flat. And he said, no, sorry, Bob, we're going to protect our retailers in this country. We're going to protect our domestic industries in this country. You're going to try and start a business in India? You can't do it. You've got to have a partner. You've got to have an Indian partner. I'm speaking from experience. I've been there. I've done business in India. Anyhow, so Walmart won't qualify for this. These are only single-brand stores. They're going to allow, this is the first little crack in the door. And the cons and neocons and corporatists are all up in, you know, enthusiastic about it. They are all excited about this. I mean, we're talking about a $250 billion retail market, the eighth largest in the world, the Indian market. But the only kind of stores that they're going to allow are single-brand stores. In other words, Nike can open a store where they only sell Nikes. Reebok can open a store where they only sell Reebok. I wonder if Walmart will just start branding everything, Walmart brand peas, Walmart brand ketchup, Walmart brand blue jeans, and try and get around it that way. In any case, they just agreed to do this. And however, as Mr. Nath, Kemal Nath, representative of the Indian government, said, the new policy would allow, you know, these sort of accesses, Reebok and Nike and so on, to sell their own products. However, he told reporters, such companies will need government approval before setting up shop. Detailed guidelines will be worked out, he said. You know, keep in mind, this is about, there is no such thing as a free market. I mean, it's very simple. There is no such thing as a free market. And there is no one economy. Different economies in different countries function in different ways, as the result of a variety of factors, ranging from the availability of natural resources, the ratio of those natural resources to the population, the level of development of the industrial infrastructure of the society, the level of development of the social infrastructure and educational infrastructure of the society, the level of historic wealth. For example, Spain went from being a little two-bit backwater to being one of the greatest powers in the world in less than 100 years. Why? Because they found all this gold in the Americas and brought it back in the 1400s. Sudden change, right? So anyhow, there's all these things that go to make up the standard of living in a country and the components of a local economy. The Wall Street Journal article that I'm referencing here in today's paper goes on to say, foreign competition in the sector is a political powder keg in India. Opponents of liberalization argue it will put some of the 12 million mom-and-pop stores that currently dominate the retail sector out of business. Sales by efficient modern retailers and branded chain stores are expected to climb more than 15% during the next 10 years. So they're starting to nibble away in India. This is just what we saw here in the United States in the 80s. The beginning of the nibbling away of the American dream. The Indians are seeing the beginning of this, and a lot of them are very upset about it. But the Indian Parliament is going to go along with it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Stacy in Eureka, California. Hey, Stacy, what's up?
You had someone on, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago, but they were talking about, I can't remember what country it was, but they were talking about a count of vote or count the vote campaign.
Yeah, it was Rich McClure who actually runs KUDO up the Anchorage affiliate. In fact, those spots you were hearing just a few minutes ago from him.
So this is a 1+1=2.
Yeah, he was living in Serbia during the time of the elections after Milosevic. Yeah.
I think that's a great idea that we just need to start getting that out, and I know it will work because the people will respond. I went to a couple of Grateful Dead tours during the 2004 election, and the kids were lining up. They had a thing going called Headcount, and it was registering people at the shows. And these were the people that were in line in Ohio waiting 9 hours to vote.
Yeah.
And then their vote wasn't even counted.
Yeah, well, apparently, yeah.
So this is what really needs to be done, and I would like to see the government collect my vote with as much zeal as they collect my taxes, like the IRS does.
Yeah, there you go. And they sure haven't outsourced that one yet. Stacey,
and if they're worried about getting campaign people to, or if they're worried about people running these elections, you know, they don't have enough people, why don't they make it like a jury duty type system where everybody has to go work the campaign or work the polling places once in your lifetime?
Yeah, well, at least, you know, in Australia, for example, if you fail to vote, there's an extra $25 bill on your tax bill at the end of the year. So, you know, it's kind of a $25 penalty if you don't vote. That's about as close as I think we could get. Jury duty is... What we really want to do, Stacey, is we want to make people enthusiastic about participating in the political process, not make it you've got to do this. I think that the way to do that is to make politics more open and more transparent, and the main way to do that is through public funding, number one, public funding of elections, and number two, breaking up big media monopolies and saying if you want to be in the media business, you have to be only in the media business. So, you know, cut the networks free of the big corporations and defense contractors that own them and let them operate on their own. And go back to the rules that we had before Reagan changed them in the mid-80s that said that, local radio and TV stations have to perform public service in order to maintain their license, and that is they have to give free time to local politicians, and they have to run the real news. So the networks will start running real news again rather than infotainment. But maybe I'm simplistic, but that's my suggestion. Stacey, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate hearing from you. Mike in Pebble Beach, California. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. My question stems from your early comment on KUDO's discussion about the vote count in Alaska.
Right.
And I think, and you've just been saying over and over again, you've got to get people's attention. My question to you is, the trustworthiness of Diebold seems to me to be in question.
Yeah.
And one way of getting people's attention, I think, especially those who are not interested in politics, is to talk about their money. And as I understand it, Diebold has big involvement with banking, brokerage, other financial businesses.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't trust them to count the vote, why would you want to trust them with your money?
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, if you go to an ATM in most parts of the country, you are using a Diebold ATM, which, by the way, will print a receipt for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is one. I mean, they capitalized on the good name that they had built in the banking business by rolling out these voting machines, which now, you know, we find are easily hacked. Interesting point, Mike. And so what are you suggesting, that people should boycott Diebold ATMs or tell their banks that
think about the fact that if you can't trust Diebold to count your vote, why would you trust them to count your money?
Well, that's a good point, Mike, but there's a bigger issue here, and we've got to make sure that we don't lose sight of the bigger issue. The bigger issue is that it has nothing to do with Diebold. The bigger issue is, should our vote have ever been privatized in the first place? What on God's earth, why do we have private corporations inserting themselves between me and my vote and the government that I'm voting for? I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. If you're going to privatize, you know, I can understand, I disagree with it, but I can understand saying, you know, cities saying that they're going to privatize their sewage system or something. You know, maybe they think they can do a better deal. But privatize the vote? That's what's happened. Our vote has been privatized, and the private corporations that we've turned it over to are turning out not to be so trustworthy. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We say we build democracy, but really build refineries and drill for our prosperity from oil in the ground.
And welcome back, my friends.
The earth might be warming from the oil that would burn, but I'm a simple man and that's too difficult to learn. Forget about renewables like solar energy, 'cause oil made my pappy rich, it's good enough for me.
Indeed, welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI. Hey, Paula, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's up?
Well, I was listening to you yesterday, and you were calling for public financing of campaigns,
mm-hmm.
which I used to be for when mm-hmm. I was younger and more naive, and I used to check off my little box on my income tax.
Your $3?
It was
to $5 now, is it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That was a long time ago. But now I look at every reform that we have ever had that we fought for has been subverted by corporations. And the money that goes to the media in times of campaigns, it means a lot to them. It's like Christmas for stores, you know. It's like I read somewhere that that's where they get the most money is from this campaign, these campaign ads that we all hate.
That's right.
And so instead of making the people of the country pay more money to have more campaign ads that they hate, I think we should realize, like they did in Nicaragua, remember when Reagan was saying, oh, these are not real elections, and I was looking at them going, Jesus, we should have elections like that here. They had public, the airwaves were open to every candidate to give a certain amount of time to say what they were for, and I forget what else they did, but we could do that here. They're public airwaves. A campaign is news and should be treated as such. It should be on the news program.
I agree with you, Paula. And in fact, this is how it used to be in the United States. This is why there was a Kennedy-Nixon debate.
Exactly.
Right up until the mid-80s, part of the Fairness Doctrine, part of the Fairness Doctrine was kind of problematic now because it would have outlawed this program, for example. But other parts of the Fairness Doctrine required radio stations and television stations as part of their, you know, maintain their licensed business to give free airtime to politicians. And the networks in particular have, but a lot of local stations, this has become a major revenue source for them. And it's going to be really tough to wean them away from it. If you were to change that. But, you know, I agree with you.
Let's call for a reform that will mean something. Well, my husband's running for governor of Illinois in the Green Party, for one thing. And I know if there was public financing, he wouldn't get any. So I have a self-interest here.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, we have publicly funded elections here in the city of Portland, where I live now. The state of Arizona, they're doing this. They're doing it in Maine, I believe. And in Arizona, in fact, the governor was elected as a public finance campaign candidate. You know, I mean, you've got just average people now serving in the legislatures of these states and in the city council here in Portland as a result of public financing of elections. And so I think that if we can synthesize your concern, which I agree with, and by the way, when I call for public funding of elections, I also call for, you know, an obligation on the part of the media to cover politics and cover politicians and provide for public debate and things like that as part of their
well,
as part of their.
I heard you say that, so I was like, oh, that's good, but let's just keep it there and not go on to giving the.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Paula. You said your husband's running for governor of Illinois on the Green Party ticket. You want to plug a website for him?
Pardon?
You want to mention your husband's website for his campaign?
WhitneyForGov.something.
.org, most likely.
Probably, yeah.
Whitney for Gov. Okay, good on you. Paula, thanks a lot for the call. And
okay.
Tell your husband and I said good luck and best wishes. John in Temple, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, at the opening of your program, you were speaking rather disparagingly of people who invest. Or who make all of their money from investing. And, you know, I prefer to look at it.
Well, John, stop, if I can just pause you right for a moment there.
Okay.
What I wasn't speaking disparagingly of people who invest for a living. I have been the recipient of that, and I've been the benefactor. My point was that people who invest for a living are set aside under our tax law as a separate category of person. They pay a maximum of 15% income tax, and they pay no Social Security tax. Whereas if you or I work for a living, and I do, I don't know about you, work for a living with our hands or with our mind or both, we have to pay income tax rates in the 30%, and we have to pay Social Security taxes. I think that's wrong.
I do too.
Then why are we disagreeing?
From a certain perspective. I mean, I'm not. I have my own business, okay? And my original point was, I hope to one day be a benefactor. I hope to one day have my business big enough that people want to invest.
Sure.
Okay? And for that, I'd be grateful. But
yeah. So you pay them a decent dividend, and they pay income taxes on it. It was this way in the United States from 1913 right up until last year, and I haven't noticed that there's no companies being started.
I'm sorry, say that again. I missed that.
From 1913, when the income tax started, until last year, dividends were taxed the same as regular income. And it, you know, the American economy seemed to do just fine during that period of time. You know, I own a business too. This radio show is a business, which I own. And, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could spend some money off and figure out a way not to pay as much tax on it? I think everybody kind of feels that way. But the bottom line is we live in this society, and whether we're earning our living by our investments or by our work, we are using the commons and we're part of the society. And I think that we all have collectively an obligation to participate in that society by paying our fair share of the taxes.
You know, the only problem with that is, what's a fair share? Everybody has a different perspective of what a fair share is.
Well, there we can argue about where taxes should be. Obviously, you know, as a starting point, a fair share would be, you know, let's just balance whatever it takes to balance the budget, and then we can talk to our politicians. But I don't think that creating class warfare like the Republicans have done by saying that the investing class pays a different tax rate than the working class is a good thing for America. I just don't buy it. Even though, you know, you and I and many other people aspire someday to be part of the investing class, wouldn't that be great? But still, you know, I think that even should that happen, we should be paying the same tax rate as everybody else, and as we've always done in this country. John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, it's nice to have people disagree with me in a rational fashion, although sometimes the irrational ones are fun, too. It's 57 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartmann radio program, Truth in Broadcasting.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
As you may have noticed in the news, China is now the fourth largest economy in the world. They have eclipsed France behind the United States, Japan, and Germany. Ironic, isn't it, by the way, that Japan and Germany are the second and third largest economies in the world, because Harry Truman, you know, rebuilt them in the vision of a liberal America with health insurance for everybody and strong unions. But I digress. China now number four. And Google, google.cn is the website, is the Chinese Google, you know, version of Google. And they held out for a while. They held out for about a year, I guess, is my understanding. MSN, of course, Microsoft jumped right in and said, yes, we will censor like crazy. Rupert Murdoch, for a couple of years now, you know, this is 2-3 years ago, Rupert Murdoch put up a satellite for satellite TV and said, yes, I'll allow you to censor content. So they've got Fox News in China. It's, you know, all communist dictatorship all the time. They don't call it Fox News, of course. I think it's Star is what it's called. I may be wrong. But so Murdoch, and now Google has decided that they have to do this as well. And I should throw in the caveat, I own 3 shares of Google stock. So I guess I'm a member of the investor class here with my 3 shares of Google stock. but in any case, that caveat said, what this demonstrates in my mind is the essential difference between capitalism and democracy. Because what the cons are trying to sell us is the idea that capitalism is a moral system and is necessary for democracy. And a simple look at history will demonstrate that for 7,000 years, from the rise of Gilgamesh, the first, you know, god king in Sumeria, in the city of Ur, the Epic of Gilgamesh, 7,000 years ago, the beginning of what we call modern civilization, from 7,000 years ago until 230 years ago, There was plenty of capitalism, but there had never been democracy, with the single exception of a couple hundred years in Athens three millennia ago. That little blip. But basically, for 7,000 years, lots of capitalism, no democracy. Capitalism, in fact, capitalism thrived in kingdoms, in often very repressive kingdoms. In fact, it was one of those kingdoms that we overthrew when we declared war against the British in 1776. It was a capitalist kingdom. In fact, the British East India Company, that the tea that was thrown into Boston Harbor by the Patriots in Boston in 1773, the winter of 1773, that tea was owned by the British East India Company. The stock of the British East India Company was principally owned by members of Parliament and the royal family. Queen Elizabeth I in 1600, after successfully financing, what was it, Sir Drake? I'm forgetting. Sir Francis Drake, that's it. Sir Francis Drake on his around-the-world trip with the Golden Hind was the name of his ship. She put up the money for that thing, and she got a 5,000% return on her investment. Said, hey, this is a pretty good deal. See, the Spanish were just beginning to do the same thing, financing Christopher Columbus, and he's coming back with gold and slaves. And so in 1600, the Queen incorporated, Queen Victoria, incorporated the British East India Company. And then when she died, her stock in that company went to her heir, King James. And now we're in the middle 1600s, the early middle 1600s, what, 1630, 1640, 1650, something like that. I forget the exact year. And right in there, the first colony was established on North American soil, called Jamestown, named after King James, in the state of Virginia, named after the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, by the British East India Company. Who owned most of the stock in the East India Company? King James and the members of Parliament, mostly the House of Lords. There were some 430, as I recall, initial investors in the East India Company, all of them British nobility. Capitalism existing just fine, thank you very much, a for-profit corporation making out very, very well in the presence of a repressive aristocracy, a kingdom. Capitalism does not require democracy. Now, that's not to trash capitalism. I'm all in favor of capitalism. You could argue that I'm a capitalist. Gee, I own 3 shares of Google. But people who think that capitalism is the thing that capitalism is a moral system are just simply wrong. Democracy is a moral system, and it's a system of governance. And we established it here in the United States 230 years ago, and it's under terrible assault right now by the folks like Sam Alito and George W. Bush, who think that, no, we should go back to a kingdom with the unitary executive. Yeah, you know, unitary executive is another way of describing a word that people around the world were familiar with for a long time, called kings. So now Google was faced with this problem. You know, do they go into China or not? Do they maintain? You know, they got this nice mission statement about, you know, do good. I don't have their mission statement right in front of me, but, you know, basically, first do no harm, you know, a variation on the Hippocratic Oath, or not. I mean, what are they going to do? What are they going to do about China? And they finally decided, you know, it's too big a market to ignore. It's now the fourth biggest market in the world. But if they're going to play in that sandbox, if they're going to play, you know, in that, they have to censor and block online content. And here's the strange quandary. If you're an American corporation, and Google is, the law requires, and there have been Supreme Court rulings to this effect, the most famous one was actually Michigan Supreme Court, Ford versus something. Maybe it was Dodge. It was one of the auto. I think it was Henry Ford was being sued. In any case, the Supreme Court, both at the state levels and federal levels, Supreme Courts have ruled that a corporation, the officers of a corporation, their first responsibility is to maintain and enhance the value of the stock, their shareholder equity. And so Google is looking at a situation where, you know, if they decide not to go into China, they're not doing what is required by law. increasing shareholder equity. They're giving the market away to Microsoft and Yahoo. On the other hand, if they do it, then they got, you know, a lot of people in the United States going, hey, wait a minute, how come you're helping the dictators? But on the third hand, or fourth hand, or whatever you want to call it, you know, there's a lot of other American companies who are also helping the dictators. And you could argue all of us do. I mean, I look around me. I mean, the computer I'm using, I'm you know, right in front of me, there's a Toshiba computer. It was made in China. The other PC here in the studio is a Dell. It was made in China. Well, it was actually assembled in Texas, but most of the parts are made in China. The clothes I'm wearing a pair of blue jeans. I know Levi Strauss closed up their last blue jean factory in the United States last year. I don't know where they were made, but it wasn't in the United States. It might have been in China. I mean, it's just, you know, as you just look around and see, that's how it is. So, you know, this is not a screed in particular about Google. I think it's what it is it's emblematic of, or, you know, it highlights this fundamental reality that economic systems and political systems are different things. And no matter how much the conservatives, and there are conservative Democrats as well as the majority of Republicans, and not to mention libertarians, no matter how much, and objectivists and whatnot, no matter how much conservatives try to convince us that the economic system of capitalism, which, again, as I said, I'm a fan of, is a moral system, it's not. It is simply an economic system. It is amoral. Democracy is a moral system, and democracy, participatory democracy, representative democracy, democracy in a constitutionally limited republic like we have in the United States, that is a moral system. And it's a moral system that we have a duty, in my opinion, to do everything we can to uphold, even if it means constraining the behavior of people engaged in capitalism or capitalistic efforts. And again, I'm making no specific recommendations with regard to this. I'm sure that the folks at Google just agonized over this. Although, you know, it doesn't appear that any of the other companies did. But probably they did too. I mean, we're all human here, and at least here in the United States, we're all Americans. Or many of us, most of us. So what's a company to do? Well, this is where having an alert, educated, activist citizenry is so useful to pass laws and control corporate behavior in a way that corporations are required to behave in a way that serves the community, first and foremost, so we don't end up with predatory businesses like Walmart or like the British East India Company operating by the rules. Because the rules really, you know, they're set up in a way that, frankly, they shouldn't be set up. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road.
Welcome back, my friends.
A shattering of shop windows, the bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder.
Indeed.
This is a long, this is called.
21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman, we're here with you. You know, sometimes you just didn't know what you didn't know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
You know, Tim Leary always said that LSD would reveal the DNA code. Turns out, Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize-winning father of modern genetics, the guy who discovered, who first visualized the double helix structure of DNA nearly 50 years ago, and for which he won a Nobel Prize. Well, here, let me just read you the story. The abrasive and unorthodox Crick and co-researcher James Watson famously celebrated their Eureka moment in 1953 by running from the now legendary Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge to the nearby Eagle Pub, where they announced over pints of bitter that they had discovered the secret of life. Crick, who died recently at the age of 88, told a friend that he often used LSD to boost his powers of thought. He said it was LSD, not the Eagle's warm beer, that helped him to unravel the structure of DNA, the discovery that won him the Nobel Prize. Despite his establishment image, Crick was a devotee of novelist Aldous Huxley, whose accounts of his experiments with LSD and another hallucinogen, mescaline, in the short stories The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell became cult texts for the hippies in the 60s and 70s. In the late 60s, Crick was also the founding member of SOMA, a legalized cannabis group named after the drug in Huxley's novel Brave New World. He even put his name to a famous letter to the Times of London in 1967 calling for reform in the drug laws. Fascinating. I never knew that. So, strange goings on. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I called all of the Democrats on the Gang of 14 and left them a message that this was the time for Democrats to decide whether they wanted to be gang members or members of the Democratic Party, but that the people in history probably wouldn't let them be both.
And what sort of response did you get from Lieberman, Byrd, Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu, Dan Inouye, Mark Pryor, and Ken Salazar?
Pryor and Landrieu's phone is on perpetual busy.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the staffs of those folks were very cordial and said they would pass on the message.
Good. Good on you, Jerry. Thank you. Congratulations, by the way. This is participatory democracy at its best, what Jerry is doing. It's absolutely marvelous. Mark in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Tom, Mark Frankenberg, just say no to fascism.com. Like intoxicants, capitalism can get out of hand. I mean, capitalism is an energy like a fire or a nuclear reaction. It has to be contained in order to be useful, and if it's not regulated properly, it can destroy everything around it. I mean, we got to get with people who don't normally hear this stuff or read this stuff, and through outreach. And the way that we can reach people is by showing them what we think by virtue of what we wear, by what we put on our car. Santorum's right about these bumper stickers. I'm seeing more and more thoughtful messages on cars.
Now, just so people know what you're talking about here, Mark, Rick Santorum, last week or earlier this week, I'm not sure when, for a group of people, said, if you want to stand up for your country, put a Rick Santorum bumper sticker on your car. Here's the clip. I thought I had the clip. Hang on just a second here. We'll try it.
What I'm asking all of you tonight is not to put on a uniform. Put on a bumper sticker. Is it that much to ask? Is it that much to ask to step up and serve your country?
And literally, he was asking people to serve their country by putting a Santorum for Senate bumper sticker on their car. Not even a Support the Troops bumper sticker. Specifically, he was talking about a Santorum for Senate bumper sticker.
Well, he's going to sell us a bill of goods, try to get himself into another position there. You know, I'd like to see Feingold in 08. I'd like to see all Democratic Senate this come around as far as our legislature goes. But communicating with each other as citizens is vitally important. A lot of folks out there are just consumers and not citizens. And again, here we are listening to you. You're an extremely valuable source for us. Your book, Unequal Protections, on my desk right now. I thought just What Would Jefferson Do was awesome. I really thank you for what you're doing. But the fact remains that we here today, talking with you and listening to you, are a select group, and there is a huge lumpen proletariat out there who don't know what's going on.
Yeah, and you think the bumper sticker is a good way to reach them. I'm wondering, Mark, on your website, just say no to fascism.
.com, absolutely.
.com. You sell bumper stickers?
Well, I have free bumper stickers there.
Even better.
Or you can buy batches of them. I have people that order bunches there.
Cool. So people can check it out. Mark, I think that's great. And, you know, thanks for the call, and I'm perfectly willing to plug your website. Just say no to fascism.com. Daryl in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Daryl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Yeah, excellent. I called my representatives yesterday out here in Washington.
Murray and Cantwell?
Yeah. And Murray, I just left a message, and Cantwell, I spoke to her aide, and I asked her where her stand was on Alito.
And she said?
Well, he told me she was still considering it.
Well, you know, Daryl. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's but good on you for making the phone call. That's the important first step. And Daryl, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, we got to take a break here. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Every single day, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to our program, my friends. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, we'll get you there. And you know, you're more than welcome to drop in and say hi. The White House, this now sort of old news, but worthy of repeating, the White House was told in the hours before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans that the city would probably soon be inundated with flood water, wrote Eric Lipton in the New York Times, forcing the long-term relocation of hundreds of thousands of people. This is incredible. You know, the White House knew, and yet Bush went off to play golf and cut a cake with John McCain, and FEMA did nothing. Other documents show that the weekend before Hurricane Katrina made landfall, Homeland Security Department officials predicted that its impact would be worse than a doomsday-like emergency planning exercise conducted in Louisiana in July of 2004. Now, if that doesn't feed the conspiracy theorists out here to say, oh, you know, they intentionally let them drown. I mean, let's keep in mind, there are still more people missing and unidentified bodies. There are more people missing in Louisiana right now than died in the World Trade Center on 9/11. A White House spokesman asked about the seeming contradiction between Mr. Bush's statement on September 1st. That was when he said, I don't think anybody could have anticipated the breach of the levees. Between that, the contradiction between that and the warning that the White House received before the storm got there. Said, according to Eric Lipton in the New York Times, that the president meant to say that once the storm passed and it initially looked as if New Orleans had gotten through the hurricane without catastrophic damage, no one anticipated that at that point the levees would be breached. Yeah, right. That's why they didn't bother to do anything about it. He continues, Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, who is chairwoman of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, said that despite such evidence, officials in FEMA had told investigators that leading up to Hurricane Katrina, they believed that local and state government could handle the evacuation on their own. She calls it another example of a lack of coordination and planning and a disconnect. Yeah. To be generous. To be generous. 1-866-440-8466. Mohammed in Elk Grove, California. Hey, Mohammed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You know, on the weekend I was looking at the Parade magazine, and it showed these worst dictators. The number one is the supposedly the dictator of Sudan. That's where I come from, al-Bashir. I disagree, not because I like the guy, but because he's an idiot, a figurehead. He is being run by a group of right-wing Muslim brothers who are running the country. He's just a figurehead.
Yeah.
So it is not true. He's number one. Yes, the guy is brainless.
Well, don't you think, Mohammed, that that's probably true of at least half the guys on that list?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, basically they're being run by big oil interests or religious, you know, right-wing religious interests like that.
Yeah, what bothered me, however, is the absence of some obvious examples of dictatorships. For example, the Kuwait, these darlings of the United States, the guys whose ambassador brought his daughter to pose as a victim of Saddam Hussein. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. She said that they were throwing babies out of incubators, she had been rehearsed with a Republican PR firm in Washington, D.C. It had never happened.
That's right.
And she testified before Congress, and that was the turning point. That was what George Bush Sr. needed in order to get American approval for an invasion of Kuwait.
Invasion.
Yeah.
But this is a dictatorship here. It's a family. And yesterday, the funny thing, the parliament of Kuwait yanked out the crown prince as unfit,
right,
because he's being sick. But the funny thing is that the guy whom they approved is no different. He's in age.
Yeah,
he's 75 years old, and the other guy is 77. What's the difference?
Well, the guy who's 77, who they pulled out, I can't remember his name, is incoherent, basically.
I know why.
And they replaced him with a guy who's 75, who's coherent, and you know, they'll just keep propping up people who are, you know, relatively coherent.
Reason? You want to know the real reason? I know why.
Why is it?
The real reason is that his mother or his grandmother was a concubine. Dark-skinned concubine, and they just didn't like that.
Oh, the guy they pulled out? I mean, they discovered that there was something wrong with his lineage?
They just don't like this guy to rule them.
That's fascinating.
This particular thing, but they wouldn't say it, of course.
Yeah.
They put it on his health, but that's the real reason. That's what I contend.
Interesting.
Anyway, another example is Mubarak of Egypt. He's not in that list. He's a big dictator.
Yeah.
You know, nobody but him. So this is what I want to point out.
Well, Mohammed, you did a good job of it, and I appreciate it, and thank you very much for the call. It's good to hear from you. I actually on Monday brought in, I had that issue of Parade here with me in the studio, and we had a caller who brought it up. We talked about it. We went through the list, and interesting to discover how many U.S. allies are on that list. For example, the dictator of China, among others. David and Blaine Washington on the line. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you again. Yeah, did you... do you remember when Spike Lee announced that he's making a documentary? It's probably done by now. It'd be perfect timing for him to release it about the Katrina FEMA meltdown and the ear witnesses that heard the levees or something exploding near the two levees at Brooklyn.
Right. I was going to say my recollection of, you know, what I've heard about it. I haven't talked to Spike Lee about this, and nor have I had anybody involved with the documentary on this program. But the two things that I've heard was, number one, he was making the documentary, which I thought was a great thing, and wouldn't it be great, and probably the time to bring it out would actually be October of this year, just before the November elections. And second, you know, because it's one of those Fahrenheit 9/11 kind of things. It could be. But secondly, yes, there's a number of people who heard what they thought were explosions, which may just simply have been the sound of levees breaking. I mean, I hear, We live right next to a forest. I hear trees fall, and it sounds like explosions going off.
Oh, of course.
And I'm just worried that Spike Lee might end up producing what will be dismissed as a conspiracy nut rant, when in fact there's a whole bunch of very, very real issues that need to be addressed with regard to Katrina and the failures of, not just the failures, the I would say criminal negligence of the Bush administration with regard to it.
Deadly negligence.
Yes.
Deadly. You know, and
not to mention their deadly negligence with 9/11. I mean, you know, the greatest security failure in the history of this country happened on George Bush's watch, and then the greatest natural disaster in the history of America happened on his watch, and he blew them both.
That's right, and deadly negligence in Iraq, for crying out loud.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go. He can't even fight a war.
Oh, my God. Where does it end?
You know, I'll tell you, David, it is time for us to take Howard Beale's advice.
You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
There you go, David. Are you mad as hell?
Oh, that's brilliant, Tom.
It is time to be waking up Americans. David, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. But it is time for us to be waking up and waking up our brothers and sisters, our friends, our neighbors, our parents, our kids, waking up to the reality that this democracy that for 230 years we have held together with a combination of blood, sweat, tears, bubble gum, and masking tape that we've held together. Sometimes it nearly fell apart. I mean, you know, look at the Civil War, and at other times we have brought together in extraordinary fashion. Look at the era from the 1930s through the 1950s. That this democracy is at risk, and part of what it is at risk from is Sam Alito and the Bush administration. That we have an administration that absolutely does not regard the rule of law. We have privatized our vote, privatized our elections, and Alito, of course, would you know, I'm sure enthusiastically go along with that as well. Brent in Seattle. Hey, Brent, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. In the time period that I've sat here waiting to talk to you, I realize, you know, being that our government is possibly listening to you, it has a way of quelling dissent. Just knowing that that we're being spied on and that without the right of privacy, we're...
Oh, yeah. See, this is my rant the other day about, you know, going through the airport security and that, you know, it's really a joke because the airport, I don't mean it's a joke totally, but the reality is that those guys took down those planes with box cutters and you can still get a box cutter through airport security and easily. I mean, you just put it in your pocket if it's a plastic box cutter. Not that I would recommend anybody do that. What they had to do was harden the cockpit doors. And that had been suggested back in the 70s when they were hijacking planes to Cuba. And the airline industry, you know, pushed back with through their lobbyists and said, no, it'll cost too much money. And had Bush simply said when he got that memo, when he was first notified in August of 2001 that bin Laden was going to strike and that it was going to involve hijacked airplanes, harden the cockpit doors, do it now, 9/11 might not have happened.
Mm.
Wouldn't have happened.
The reason why I called you today is this, okay. Talk of the filibuster and the reason.
Yeah, Brent, I'm going to have to ask you to just hold that thought for a minute. We got to take a break here, and we'll get back to your thoughts on Alito, which you know is certainly one of the top issues of our day right now. And once again, the toll-free number for your senators or for any members of the Senate, 888-355-3588. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain, 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You're the lucky one, so I've been told. Spring is a wind blowing down the road. Loved by many, hated by none. I'd say you were lucky, doesn't know what you felt. Not a care in the world, not a worry inside. Everything's gonna be alright, so the lucky one.
And welcome back, my friends. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with it. With you. Yeah, we can pull this country back together. We really can. By the way, I understand the toll-free number that I've been giving out, the 355-3588 number, no longer works. It's interesting. During the John Roberts nomination, the 1-877-SOB-USOB number stopped working. Well, this number just stopped working. But there are a couple of other toll-free numbers that you can use. 888-818-6641. 818-6641. And 877-851-6437. 877-851-6437. Toll-free numbers that you can use to reach your member of Congress. And now our environmental alert, our Greenwatch alert. Last year was the warmest recorded on the Earth's surface in the history of record-keeping, anyway. Unusually hot in the Arctic, U.S. Space Agency NASA said. All five of the hottest years since modern record-keeping began in the 1890s occurred within the last decade. Last year was slightly warmer than 1998, which was the previous hottest year. The rate of warming has been so rapid that this temperature that we would normally only get with an El Nino is happening even without any unusual worldwide weather disturbances, says a spokesperson for NASA, Drew Schindel of the NASA Institute. He says, over the past 30 years, Earth has warmed by 1.08 degrees Fahrenheit, and over the past 100 years, it has warmed by 1.44 degrees Fahrenheit, and we are starting to see the results of it, and it's not looking good. In fact, I would suggest that part of that results that we're starting to see is what we saw in Katrina. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Dick, hang on just a second. We were talking to Brent, weren't we, in midstream there. Hey, Brent, welcome back.
You.
Yeah. Hey,
Dick
Brent.
Dick in Ohio. How you doing today?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm going to hang on just a second here, Brent. I got Dick on.
Okay.
Dick, go ahead.
I just want to say, Tom, what you said today, I learned so much. You really, Air America, I think capitalism to me was the set of market and sellers, and democracy to me is the freedom, and I think we learned this through history, economics, and business, but very good point today, Tom.
Thank you, Dick.
Okay.
I'm glad it was useful.
Yeah,
that's what you called for?
No, I just wanted to tell you about Ohio.
Okay.
We're failing. We need new leaders, and I'm going to support the legislatures. We can't have cuts and unfair taxation. It's getting ridiculous.
Yeah, you're talking about cuts in services and
yes.
Also reductions in taxes for the wealthy. Is that the point?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the Republican mantra, Dick. It's just absolutely
yeah.
Republican mantra. Thanks a lot for the call. It's and good luck in supporting your candidates there. Ohio needs a lot of help. Brent in Seattle. Hey, Brent.
Hey, Tom. Just real quick, the reason why we need to filibuster Alito is that George Bush, because of the fraudulent elections in 2004, shouldn't even have been in the position to nominate these men.
Yeah.
I'm not
disagreeing with you. I don't think he won either election. You know, well, we know he didn't win the 2000 election. That, you know, they actually counted the vote in Florida a year later, and it was in the New York Times and the Washington Post that Al Gore won Florida. And so, number one, you know, George W. Bush was not the president in 2000. And in 2004, I'm convinced that the exit polls were right and the electronic voting machines were wrong.
If we can't fight them on this point, there really isn't much point. If being that the Bush administration is going to do whatever they want, at least let it go down in the history books that we gave it a good fight.
There you go. We go down slugging, and that's why it's so important that this guy be filibustered. I just don't get this timid Democrat theory. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Brent, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. Alice in Humboldt County. Hey, Alice.
Hello, Tom.
Always wonderful to hear from you, Alice. One of my few listeners who actually remembers Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. And soon I'll be 62.
62 or 92?
It's hard to believe how truly terrible they are, but some of us do believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They were in no rush to save a lot of poor black people who were sure to vote Democratic. These are the same folks who invaded countries and killed thousands for their own profit. They should all be in prison, Tom.
Alice, I can't disagree with you. I think that at least they should all be being investigated right now with the possibility of that. Yeah, I do agree with you. And you said you're coming up on your 92nd birthday, I thought it was?
92nd.
Yeah, well, that's
next
wonderful.
Month.
Next month. That's wonderful, Alice.
Yeah.
It's great to have you with us, and thank you for listening.
Okay.
They're on KGOE.
Yeah,
great to hear you. Oh, my goodness. We got about a minute left in Carmel in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Carmel.
Hey, Tom.
Got about a half a minute. What's up?
Okay. I just want to say I'm sending an email to every Democratic senator saying, please filibuster him. What the heck are we waiting for?
Yep.
It's like a 80-year-old spinster saving her good underwear for our wedding night. It's not going to happen. We need to fight, and we need to fight now.
Yeah, amen. Amen, Carmel. I absolutely agree with you, and I would suggest that you go beyond just sending emails and call. There's a couple of toll-free numbers here that still do work, 888-818-6641. And I'll repeat that, 888-818-6641 and 877-851-6437. 877-851-6437.
Thanks,
Carmel, thanks a lot. Thanks for the call. Yeah, you too. Keep it up. We've got, you know, keep the faith, my friends. We got to hold these Democrats to account. This is just so important. This is so important. The future of democracy is at stake here. This is a guy who does not believe in democracy. He believes in an aristocracy. I realize that's the definition of conservative, or a good part of it, but, you know, he's even beyond conservative. What can you say? He's beyond conservative. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
President George W. Bush found himself embroiled in controversy today with the publication of five photos showing him and disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff totally naked. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Yes, as Andy Borowitz reports over at BorowitzReport.com, the photos published yesterday in Payboy, a magazine devoted to naked pictures of disgraced lobbyists, appeared to fly in the face of the president's claims that he had never met Mr. Abramoff. The two photos, which appear to have been taken on five different occasions, show the two naked men smiling and shaking hands. Davis Logsdon, the magazine's photo editor, said the fact that they are smiling and shaking hands proves that they know each other. At the White House, the president's top advisors were working overtime to limit the political havoc that the nude photos of the president and Mr. Abramoff could wreak. At a press briefing this morning, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan spoke dismissively of the controversy, calling the brouhaha over the naked photos a tempest in a teapot. He said, these naked pictures of the president and Jack Abramoff are nothing out of the ordinary. In the course of his daily schedule, the president poses nude with dozens of dignitaries. Mr. McClellan said that the American people would have no problem believing that Mr. Bush posed naked with Mr. Abramoff on five different occasions without actually knowing who he was. As Mr. McClellan said, our polls show that the American people think that most of the time the president is in the Oval Office, he does not know what he is doing. Well, sounds good. Yeah. Danny Borowitz, of course, tongue-in-cheek, BorowitzReport.com. Welcome back to our program. Some more serious issues. It looks like the Bush administration, you know, part of the conservative agenda is to shift all of the burdens down to the working class, down to working people, and shift all of the benefits, all of the revenue. If I didn't point out that that Borowitz report was tongue-in-cheek, it's tongue-in-cheek. I think I said that. In any case, is to shift the burdens down to the working class and shift all of the revenue up to the what the Wall Street Journal refers to as the investor class. And one of the problems that we have in the United States is that 36 other countries in the world, all of the major industrialized countries in the world, have national health care systems where all of the taxpayers, which includes the corporations, because corporations pay taxes in all of these countries, and more taxes than they do in the United States in most of them, that corporations and individuals are helping to fund a national health care system. Well, the Bush administration would like to have nothing to do with that. They want us to end up with a health care system that is entirely paid for by you and me, by working people, as opposed to the investor class. And as opposed to corporations, they don't want corporations to pay any part of it. And right now we have the sort of the reverse. We have a healthcare system that is paid for entirely by employers, by and large. Actually, you know, employers have figured out ways to shift large chunks of that burden to employees. We'll pay $300, you pay $300 or whatever. So increasingly large chunks of the healthcare are being paid by employees. Plus, you know, when you go to see the doctor, there's a copay, and you go to the hospital, whatever happens, you know, you got to pay this and that and the other thing. And by the time all is said and done, you know, well, this is why half of all bankruptcies that happen every year in the United States happen, because working people get hit with medical bills that they can't handle, and they get wiped out. But in any case, what the Bush administration wants to do is to take the employer-paid portion of our employer-paid health insurance program here in the United States entirely out altogether. And they're going to do it through the back door. And I'm telling you, the State of the Union address is coming. And I would be amazed if this wasn't part of it. And whether it is or it isn't, this will be coming in the next year. And they're going to do it under the guise of two things. But when you hear these things, just keep in mind what this is really all about is shifting the burden for health insurance from corporations and wealthy investors to average working people. Number one, Bush, in all probability, is going to propose an increase or expansion in what he calls health savings accounts. That is the amount of money from your paycheck that you can set aside with a tax deferral or a tax reduction or a tax-free, but nonetheless, your money that you can set aside to pay for health care costs. So he's going to say, yeah, instead of setting aside, you know, whatever it is now, I'm not sure what the limit is. I think it's around $3,000 to $5,000 a year that you can set aside. Whatever that is, we'll make it $20,000 a year you can set aside. So, you know, it's a good deal for multimillionaires and billionaires. The average person, it'll mean nothing to them. But step one, increase health savings accounts. And step two, tax simplification. You are going to hear this phrase. This is coming down the road. Bush is going to call it tax simplification. And what it really is going to mean is higher taxes for average working people and lower taxes for you know, Bush and his elite, for the Bush crowd. You know, some call you the haves and the have-nots. Some call you the elite. I call you my base. Well, play into his base. He will be doing that. And people say, well, you know, but people in low-income tax brackets, I mean, you know, people only make $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 a year. They don't pay very much in income taxes. No, but they pay a higher proportion of their income in taxes than millionaires and billionaires do. How can that be? The millionaires and billionaires are paying higher income taxes. Well, because the people in the lower tax brackets are paying almost all of, well, not almost, they're paying all of their income out just in living expenses throughout the course of the year, and so they're paying sales tax on all of that. They're paying property tax on the property that they live on, and it's the only property that they're living on. And, you know, they don't have three vacation homes or whatever. And on it goes. They're paying a higher chunk of their, you know, of their income in taxes. And when Thomas Paine first proposed progressive taxation in his book, The Rights of Man, and when Thomas Jefferson talked about progressive taxation, Jefferson's quote, I don't have it right in front of me, it's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Jefferson came right out and said, you know, that the necessities of life, the necessaries of life is the phrase that he used, should not be taxed. There should be no tax on the income required to cover the necessaries of life. Only after the necessaries of life, the necessities of life, you know, somebody has enough money to cover those, then should a person be paying taxes? This is Thomas Jefferson saying this. And we have held to this for years and years, that people who are, you know, at the bottom of the economic ladder, as it were, pay less in taxes. They're consuming less of the commons. They're consuming, you know, they're not using our court system like corporations do. You know, enforcing contracts and things. They're not using, just by and large, they're not using our commons as heavily as somebody who's much wealthier. And not flying around using the air traffic control system, and on it goes. And so, therefore, we have progressive taxation. But I'm telling you, this is coming. This is coming. And, in fact, my guess is that Bush is going to propose sometime in the next year or so to end all of the tax breaks for employers who pay for employee health insurance. Right now we have this weird situation where if you are, for example, self-employed, and, you know, say you make your living, you know, doing freelance stuff, whatever it may be, whether it's, you know, writing articles for magazines or it's mowing lawns in the neighborhood or, you know, whatever, you're self-employed. If you go out and buy health insurance for yourself, you have to pay income tax on the money before you can buy the health insurance. So a $500 a month health insurance policy might actually cost you $700 or $800 a month, because that's how much money you have to earn, and then you pay the taxes on it, and then with the tax, the after-tax income, you buy the health insurance. However, if you create a one-person corporation, that corporation can buy the, and you put, you know, $500 a month into that corporation in income, allow the corporation to take some of your income. That corporation can then buy your health insurance and pay no taxes on it. Because we have wanted historically to encourage employers to provide health insurance to employees. This is something that goes back to the Eisenhower administration. Actually, I think it goes back to the Truman administration. And so it is a strange paradox where all you have to do is, you know, spend $300 to incorporate, and you can have your own health insurance tax-free, right? Well, the Bush administration, I suspect, is going to do away with that. I just see this whole thing coming to a screeching halt. They're trying to take us back to 1905. Back, you know, the Lochner decision, the Supreme Court Lochner decision. This is what Sam Alito will do on the Supreme Court. This is what John Roberts will do on the Supreme Court. This is what Scalia and Thomas will do on the Supreme Court. Say things like, well, you know, unless the company is engaged in interstate commerce, doing business across state borders, the federal government has no business telling them whether they can hire child labor, telling them the maximum number of hours people can work, telling them the minimum wage people have to work by, guaranteeing that they have some sort of safety net in the form of unemployment insurance, providing Social Security, providing Medicare. The Supreme Court between 1905 and 1936 would have found all of those things unconstitutional. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Katrina blew through the town like waters flooded all around. No money to raise levees high, and so we watched New Orleans die. Bill Clinton was a Democrat. He saved us money in his hat. He fell from grace, the story goes. Then Georgie put us in the hole.
Why did he put us in the hole? Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org is with us. He's the coordinator of VAWatchdog.org, one of the best organizations around looking out for the interests of veterans here in the United States, based out of Vancouver, Washington. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you with us, Larry. The Marine Corps says that reporting post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms is not a career ender. Is that so?
Well, it depends who you ask. It depends if you ask the spokesperson for the Corps or if you ask the typical Marine. It basically, the problem there is, and this has always been true and it continues today, and I get reports regularly from troops coming out of the field, coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, that the troops do not want to report mental health issues or anything that could be associated with PTSD-like symptoms. It is, quite frankly, it's a career ender. There's still a huge stigma in the military about PTSD or what some people want to call combat stress or stress situations like that. So
yeah, we used to call it shell shock in World War II and World War I. It was called battle fatigue.
Battle fatigue, and it's gone by a number of different names. But even beyond PTSD, any mental health issues they want to stay from, because traditionally these have been career enders. And no matter what the Corps says or other military officials, your records are flagged with a mental health flag, that you do have mental health issues. And it depends then. You're under the magnifying glass.
Right. Now, there's a larger issue here, too, Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org, and that is that there are some 80, 90,000, as I recall, vets who are on essentially full disability as a result of post-traumatic stress disorder. And the Veterans Administration has, over the last few months, ordered a review of this, basically asked them all to go through a whole nother testing procedure, because it's expensive. This is expensive for the Veterans Administration to have people with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right. Currently, the number is 72,000 veterans receiving 100% PTSD benefits. It's costing the VA over $4.5 billion, with a B, dollars per year.
Wow.
For this compensation. What they eventually did was they decided to review these people because they thought that there was going to be some fraud there. This was their excuse for looking at it. They found no fraud, so they dropped that review. What they have done now, though, is a couple of different things. One, they have gone in and contracted with the Institute of Medicine to do a new review of PTSD diagnosis and treatment. Basically, they're asking the Institute of Medicine to second-guess the American Psychiatric Association. What the VA is doing is they're looking for a new definition of PTSD.
Do you think...
Beg your pardon?
No, I was going to say, Larry Scott, do you think that the current the Doonesbury column, Gary Trudeau bringing this to everybody's attention, doing such a good job of it, I think, is going to help veterans who are dealing with these very, very difficult issues of adjusting and dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, I think it brings it to the public's eye. And that's very important because that hasn't been done before. This is something that, generally speaking, the mass media or the mainstream media has stayed away from. We're seeing a few more stories. A few weeks ago, there was a front page story in the Washington Post, New York Times, and some of the other big papers have picked it up. But you don't see a lot of in-depth reporting about PTSD. So I feel the Doonesbury strips are going to help. They're going to bring it to a wider audience, make more people aware. But one of the problems that veterans are facing now with this new PTSD review coming up is the attitude of the VA and the military. VA Secretary Jim Nicholson has said that PTSD can be cured, and just yesterday in an interview on Public Radio International on the PR program The World, we had the head psychiatrist in the Army, and that's Army Colonel Elspeth Ritchie, tell PRI that PTSD can be cured. So what veterans are now looking at, Tom, is a really kind of an ugly situation. If this is the official attitude of the military and the VA, that with intervention there is a cure, veterans feel that should there be PTSD-like symptoms or episodes after they leave the military, then the military will be able to say, oh, no, you've been cured because we counseled you or we gave you this medication.
Or and then the EMDR.
Right, and the VA will be able to say, oh, no, the military says you were cured, so you are not eligible for treatment or compensation. So it's a very ugly picture that is forming right now on the front with mental health problems in the military and the VA.
We're talking with Larry Scott of VAWatchdog.org, VAWatchdog.org. And, Larry, we just have 1 minute left. You've got an article on your website, Discarded Heroes, Washington Sends Them Off to War, Then. What's going on?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch you, Tom. I had a little glitch in my audio.
That's quite all right. The discarded heroes you talk about on your website, the Bush administration, they're walking away from our vets?
It talks about in this particular article is about a young couple, about a fellow who came back from Iraq, and all of the problems he's had receiving treatment at the VA, and also the fact that he cannot get the VA to release any education funds for him. The VA now has been holding up education funds for vets for 2 years in some instances, and these guys are finding themselves with no money for school, no treatment for mental health issues or other
problems. You can learn more about all this stuff over at VAWatchdog.org. Larry Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, appreciated.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We bang the drum slowly and play the fife slowly. You know the song in my heart. In the turning of twilight, in the shadows of moonlight, you can show me a new place to start. I've torn my clothes and I've drained the cup, stepping away at it all, thinking of you. When the sun comes up, where teardrops fall.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we run rings around the right wing every single day. Welcome back to our program, 1-866-440-8466. Our phone number, if you want to drop into our live chat room, you're going to drop by TomHartman.com and click the live chat link, and that'll get you there. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington on the line. Hey, David, what's up?
Yes, Tom, I'd like to ask a question. I have a couple points, but the first one was about the Ohio election. In the last election there was an initiative, five initiatives, I believe, relating to voting changes. And this Columbus paper, which has never failed in its polls to predict the winner or the outcome of the election, showed that 65% of the people were going to vote for the initiative. But when the final results came out, 65% voted against it.
Right.
This is
actually it was three out of four of the items on the ballot initiative. One was supported by the voting machine companies. Two, three, and four were opposed by the voting machine companies. And on item number one, on ballot initiative number one, the polling and the results that the of the election, and by the way, this was a special election. This wasn't the 2004 election.
No,
this was just in the last couple of months.
Yeah.
On item one, what the poll, I believe it was the Columbus Dispatch, the poll was 100% accurate. On items two, three, and four, the poll was only 100% accurate if you reversed the results.
Yeah,
and then on item five, there was, you know, I think it was, you know, within the range of error. And it's got a lot of people scratching their heads.
Well,
and
what are the Ohio people doing about these irregularities? Not only that, but the 2004 election.
Well, what happened, I think in the newspaper business and the news business as a whole, there is this fear of causing people to lose faith in the system. And basically what happened was after that election, the newspaper came out and said, we must have goofed.
And the same thing happened in Alaska recently. The Diebold machines up there, they refused to release the records.
Oh, yeah, that's we opened the program with that. And, in fact, we'll just very quickly revisit that for you, David, because it's been, you know, a lot of people have, it's been 2.5 hours. A lot of people didn't hear it. But, yes, the in Alaska, there was a 100,000 vote discrepancy. And Diebold said, and so the Democratic Party went to the state of Alaska, and said, we'd like to see the actual records of the vote. And the state went to Diebold and said, may we have the records of the vote? And Diebold said, no, you can't. That's a trade secret. It's proprietary information. And so the state is in this terrible position where they can't even share the information because Diebold says it's proprietary. So our Alaska affiliate, the station in Anchorage, Alaska, that carries this program, KUDO, they time delay it a couple hours, so you don't hear very many callers from Alaska, but nonetheless, they carry the program. They put together some spots, some spoof spots. This is a phony Diebold spot that was put together by the folks over at KUDO. It's really great. Here's an example of the work that they're doing.
Is there no legal...
Just listen.
States and politicians, do your opponents have a political machine? Well, we can help you go them one better. You haven't met a political machine unless you've teamed up with a Diebold machine. With Diebold on your side, you can't be beat. And no unsightly paper trails, no expensive recounts, no delays in your inauguration. Not with Diebold. At Diebold, we give you the results you want with the push of a button. Back in the old days, counting ballots was so dull, boring, tedious, and the results never what you hoped for. Not anymore. At Diebold, we've taken vote counting and added creativity. Call Diebold today and start building your political dynasty. Ask about our double money-back guarantee if your candidate is not elected. Diebold, we don't count because you don't count.
There you go.
There's no legal recourse the Democratic Party can seek.
This is playing itself out right now. I mean, this is literally in today's news that the Democratic Party, or yesterday's news, and, you know, today it's ongoing. The Democratic Party is saying, you know, we would like to see these numbers, and Diebold is saying this is proprietary information. We won't let you see the database.
Well, there's one other issue. Last week we were talking about the states' right issues of the conservatives on the Supreme Court. You failed to mention, or maybe you did and I didn't hear it, that on the states' rights of the marijuana, medical marijuana, Scalia and Thomas voted for the states' right to pass those laws. Yet on a moral issue, like the abortion problem recently, there was a 9-0 vote, they did not side with the states on that. And
yeah, you're talking about death with dignity?
The most recent thing last week we're discussing, but that wasn't mentioned, about their states' rights thing is pick and choose.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Marijuana, they were all for the state's right to have medical marijuana laws.
Yeah, but with death with dignity, with the physician-assisted suicide, they're Scalia, Thomas, and Roberts are like, no way, because it offended them. This is the concern that I think a lot of people have about people who have very strongly held religious beliefs in a church that is involving itself in governance in the state very aggressively, and I think it's a legitimate concern. By the way, here's one other spot from KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska, about Diebold, given, you know, what's going on in Alaska right now. Another phony Diebold spot for you. Great start-out music here.
Are you a Republican election official? Diebold voting machines make your job easier. For instance, in Alaska, our Diebold vote total shows President George Bush getting almost 191,000 votes. But if you add up the total for the president in each of the 40 election districts...
I've got your number and more.
Counted by Diebold AccuVote machines, Bush got 293,000 votes. That's a difference of 101,000 votes. Confused? That's our goal. The press, the public, the Democrats, they'll never get it. And they never will, because we keep our computer counting code a big secret.
It's easy, like taking candy from a baby.
Who really needs elections? At Diebold, we program your future.
New slogans for the company. It's just, this is absolutely great. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I remember those songs well, if I may say that.
Yeah, I was...
Gary Lewis and the Playboys.
Yep, Louise and I this morning when we were first playing these things, Louise was waving her arms back and forth. She goes, this is really dating me, but I was 13 years old dancing to this, you know, it's...
Oh, God bless you both. Jeez. And that was Len Barry, I think.
I don't remember.
Yeah, that's Len Barry.
Yeah, okay.
The other one.
Yeah.
Only because I'm 60 and I guess, but I'm still a hard charging Democrat. But
there you go.
Having said that, I'd like to weigh in on Mr. What's his name? Is that, oh, Alito.
Scalia?
Scalia?
Alito. Yeah, Alito. That's right, yeah.
I'm obviously rejecting. I did call both the senators. I called Senator Spector's office, a man that I like.
I'm curious what Spector had to say about this, because he's supposedly pro-life, and Alito has all but come out and said, you know, he's sworn a blood oath to take down Roe v. Wade.
And I called, and I'm not a person that does this, but I am going to do it now. I did call Rick Santomonious Santorum's office.
Mm-hmm.
Rick
Santorum, who, by the way, I just a little clip here. Rick Santorum telling you what he wants you to do for your country.
Heard that.
Yeah,
here's
just a little clip.
What I'm asking all of you tonight,
are you serious?
Is not to put on a uniform, put on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, he wants people to put on a Santorum bumper sticker. That's what you could do for America.
No, I understand. If I may say this, can I tell you my thinking on this?
Sure.
These people are not. How should I say this? They're not bad. They care about their family, love their families, and this. They are just a different breed of cat, and we must reject them.
Well, I've said for many years on this program and in other venues, I don't think that that what we're looking at, by and large, are actually evil or bad people.
No.
In fact, there are some people, you know, the Duke Cunninghams of the world who get caught up in it, or the Tom DeLays who get so seduced by wealth and power.
And
that
some
they
on
go
our
over
side,
the dark
too.
Side. Yeah, sure. But the fact of the matter is that we have two functionally different worldviews in the United States of America, and we have since the founding of this country. One side, which calls itself conservative and has since the founding of this country, believes functionally in an aristocracy, and the other side believes in the power of the people, and that's called, you know, the liberals or progressives. And by and large, the Democratic Party.
And you're getting to my bottom line, if you will. Obviously, I'm a tremendous F. Franklin Delano Roosevelt admirer. And that is the difference, and I'm going to let you go here, and you can comment on what I'm going to. Obviously, I've said it before. That is the difference, if you will, and I don't want to get too deep about it, but I strongly believe this. That is the difference. When people say there's not a difference in the parties, I think we're in danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
There's a huge difference in the parties.
In that when man or woman, for that matter, makes a mistake, the difference is Franklin Delano Roosevelt believed they made this mistake on the side of what? On the side of compassion and decency, but not this crowd.
Yeah, better a government.
Better the occasional fault of a government living in the spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government who's in power now, I hate to say it, frozen in the ice of their own indifference. They just can't get out of their own way. We can't let them get away with it.
Yeah, well said, Gary.
Thanks
a lot. Good to hear from you. And you're going to have me dragging that clip out again. Franklin Roosevelt actually saying that. No, I won't do that this time. We have a few other callers, other things to talk about. But right, and people have to get it, that there is a very real difference in the worldview of people on the left and the right in America. It's 54 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air. From those lads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real. Or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder. From the sirens night and day. From the fires of the homeless. From the...
spirit of charity than the consistent omission of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
Welcome back, my friends. Yeah, Gary made me do it. What can I say? Franklin Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of his most famous quotes there. Whit in Scottsdale, Arizona on the line. Hey, Whit.
Good afternoon, Tom.
What's up?
Hey, my dad died in the VA hospital. And he would have never blamed Roosevelt for getting him hooked on cigarettes, having volunteered for the U.S. Army the day after December 7th, any more than he would have blamed Roosevelt for the worst attack on U.S. soil ever that he should have seen coming.
Well, I honor your father's service, and I think it's great that he made use of the socialized medicine in the VA
system. But I don't blame Roosevelt anymore than my dad would.
Yep.
But where do you get off blaming Bush for September 11th based on some PDF on August 7th, 2001.
To the best of my knowledge, Whit, Roosevelt didn't get 56 specific warnings that Pearl Harbor was about to happen. And I'm telling you, the Republicans tried to find
a million people by the time December 7th happened or not.
Say that again?
Were they a warring faction? How many people had Germany already murdered before my dad volunteered for service, for which... he, like I said before on your radio station,
you're,
my dad now wishes Roosevelt had declared war on Germany in September of 1939.
Well, I agree with your father.
Knowing all that we know after the fact.
Whit, I agree with you.
So, Tom, if you'd been...
I think it was a terrible problem. Whit, you have to understand the dynamic of the time. At that time, Roosevelt wanted to declare war on Germany much earlier than he did. However, the Republicans were absolutely stonewalling. I mean, on a regular basis, they were taking the floor. No, I'm serious. On a regular basis, they were taking the floor of the House and the Senate and denouncing Roosevelt for what they called an illegal power grab, saying that he was going to try and basically lie us into a war by saying that nasty Hitler was doing things that Hitler was not doing. And if you want to read those speeches by those Republicans, dozens of them, it's something like 70 of these different speeches by 70 more or less different Republicans in the House and Senate. Rex Stout, one of the most famous writers in the history of America, over 70 million books in print, compiled them into a single book. It's called The Illustrious Dunderheads. It's been out of print for 40 years, but you can still find used copies online with it. And you can read the actual speeches.
Those speeches sound just like Democratic speeches today about George Bush lying us into war in Iraq, and you can compare them and read them and think, God, they look exactly alike. But I don't blame Roosevelt.
But see, there's a big difference, Whit. There's a huge difference. Saddam Hussein was not Adolf Hitler. Saddam Hussein was not marching across Europe. He wasn't even marching across the Middle East. Saddam Hussein was in a box, nice and safely in a box.
Tom, Adolf Hitler and his Third Reich could have never attacked the United States of America and never did, but we attacked Germany rightfully, and we should have done it years
ago. We attacked Germany because they declared war on us. We attacked Germany because they declared war on us, not the other way around.
Tom, that
yes,
doesn't
sir?
Mean anything. I can declare war on you. It doesn't mean anything. But
It does if you're a sovereign nation, Whit. I'm sorry. Just, you know, if a sovereign nation declares war on us, we can respond.
Tom?
Yes, sir.
Okay, if Bush stole the election from one John Forbes Heinz Kerry, okay, and it's so self-evident to you.
Heinz Kerry?
Why, yes, I'd like to remind the viewer, your listeners, how super duper 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 rich John Forbes Heinz Kerry and his disgusting wife are.
Have you looked at the wealth of the Bush dynasty recently, Whit?
$200 million to the name, okay?
Have you looked at the wealth of the Bush dynasty recently, Whit?
I don't make fun of people having wealth.
You do.
I think you just did. You were just making fun of John Kerry for it.
Class warfare on my fellow human being accountable for those people they do support that are super rich and don't do jack with their money for the poor.
Like, well, Whit, you know, we're getting off into weird territory here, but I let you have your say, and I appreciate your call. Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, why do you let him go on? I mean, there's no knowledge of the history of America at that. There's no knowledge of Father Coughlin. No knowledge of Joseph Kennedy Sr., no knowledge of Charles Lindbergh, no knowledge of the America First bunch of haters.
You're absolutely right, Steve. And the fact of the matter is that he shares that lack of knowledge with probably 90% of America right now. And that's why I think it's important that occasionally, you know, for that matter, anytime anybody with that point of view wants to come on this program, I'll bring them on and I will rebut what they have to say so that when somebody tries to say it to you or to somebody in your family.
I appreciate that. But, you know, fully 50% of this country wanted to join the war on Germany's side. I mean, he was in quite a situation there.
Oh, Roosevelt was in a terrible situation. Anti-Semitism was exploding, and Father Coughlin was pouring gasoline on that anti-Semitism here in the United States.
It was a horrible situation, and thank God, you know, these rich bastards today ought to bend down and kiss, I don't know what, the hemline of a coat on a statue of Roosevelt, that he saved the free world for them to make family fortunes over the next 70 years.
Okay, Steve, I'm sorry, it's over the edge. MJ in Olympia, Washington, you're on the air.
Yes. Oh, I didn't think I would get on.
Well, I'm sorry, we just have a few seconds left, MJ. You got something quick to say?
About it, if the Republicans rig the election this time around.
Well, the way that we can do anything about it, MJ, and you ask a very good question, how can we do anything about it if the Republicans rig the election? We can show up in huge numbers and then, you know, take the elections. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, John Conyers is going to be here with us tomorrow to talk about impeachment. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Are you losing your hair?